Content warning. This podcast contains depictions of and discussions on gender-based violence. Audience discretion is advised.
You're leaving a group of friends at a busy restaurant. It's been a great night, good food, old friends. You don't get to do this enough. It's late, and you parked a few blocks away. The streets are pretty quiet, just a handful of late-night walkers and a couple on their way home from date night. This area is pretty safe, but it's not totally unusual to hear of an opportunistic mugging on the news. Sometimes the news is a little more serious, a stabbing or a shooting, but it's rare. You pick up your pace and try to just focus on getting to the car. You're not drawing attention to yourself, and it's a few minutes away. You'll be fine if you stay in well-lit areas. You get to your car, jump in, lock the door, and start the ignition. You feel safer, protected. You turn up the heat, turn on the radio, and drive home. What were you worried about? You wonder whether 24-hour news and TV shows have clouded your perspective. You might have felt unsafe for a moment, but that doesn't mean you were at risk. Chances are, most of us can relate to this feeling. Being aware of our surroundings and situations is never a bad thing, but most of us are lucky enough to never be put in an unsafe situation. Safety is a thing most of us take for granted. But rewind that scenario from the perspective of someone who has experienced intimate partner violence, has escaped an abusive partner, and begun to rebuild their life. Imagine knowing their former partner is still out there. Whether they are an active risk or not, the thought of a chance encounter is enough to incite traumatic feelings. For some women living with more extreme cases of intimate partner violence, they may have secretly mapped out and executed an escape plan from an abusive and controlling spouse. Safety for them may be a matter of life or death. We wish this was an exaggeration or a rarity, but the fact is, it most certainly is not. The Canadian Femicide Observatory for Justice and Accountability reports that in 2022, 184 women and girls were violently killed, primarily by men, which means one woman or girl is killed every 48 hours. Welcome to Somebody Must Say These Things. I'm your host, Ginger McPhee. In this episode, we hope to share a deeper understanding of what safety means to victims of gender-based violence and to those who support them. How has it affected them, and how does it continue to do so after escaping an abusive environment? Firstly, to understand safety, you first need to understand what women are seeking safety from. Abuse is defined by three main categories: psychological, physical, and sexual. Psychological violence encompasses forms of abuse that target a person's emotional, mental, or financial well-being, or impede their personal freedom or sense of safety. Here's Willow House's Jody McDavid.
Psychological abuse, it can take a lot of forms. you get everything from people who will, you know, attempt to confine somebody or deprive them of their social connections, trying to make their world smaller and smaller. You get people who their partner will just like mentally wear them down, you know, tell them that they're not good enough, tell them that nobody else would want them, tell them that they're dumb, all those sorts of things. That can just be in many ways, one of the more damaging types of abuse, because it really affects somebody's self-esteem and their mental health. The psychological and physical abuse we'll see a lot more often in like long-term partners, not to say it can't happen in short-term partners.
Physical violence includes forms of abuse that involve physical assault or the threat of physical assault.
Physical abuse would be what people would understand as like classic abuse. This is what a lot of people have when they think of domestic violence. This is what they think of. So, you know, typically it involves somebody laying hands on somebody else. Sometimes there could be marks, sometimes not. A lot of abusers are very careful about that. And, you know, a lot of times the victim is made to feel that it's their fault, that if they've done something differently, this wouldn't have happened. But, you know, there's often no rhyme or reason to it. One of the interesting things about physical abuse that's kind of come to light now is that people used to think, well, the abuser can't control themselves. However, you will find like people are likely not physically abusing somebody like in the doctor's office, or they're also not like physically abusing somebody where it can be seen typically. So that's just another kind of like something else that started to be discussed a fair amount about that.
Sexual violence includes sexual assault or threats of sexual assault, being made to perform sex acts that the victim did not want to perform, and forcing or attempting to force the victim to have sex.
Some of the abusive type things was like, I had to have sex with him for $25 to feed my daughter. He was a log truck driver, so he could leave us in isolation for many weeks on end and live in the cab of his truck.
But sexual abuse we see happen, you know, in every type of relationship, everything from people being made to feel that they have to have sex in response to having like a roof over their head, or things paid for, or, you know, they've been manipulated to such an extent that they've been told like they don't have a right to have any consent or anything, that when their partner demands sex, they have to have sex. You know, so we see everything from rape in a relationship to people who've been, you know, sexually assaulted just because they're vulnerable, wrong place, wrong time. Or, you know, we have people who are sexual predators who are like routinely sexually assaulting people. And again, sexual assault can include everything from like just inappropriate and unwanted touching, you know, right up to rape.
If you have an abusive partner capable of any of these forms of abuse, then actively escaping them will no doubt cause concern for repercussions.
I didn't even have the keys to my own house. Like, I would have to take my purse, which had my bank card and those type of things, and wear them in like a duffel bag and put them across over my neck and across my shoulder, and I would sleep on that stuff so that he couldn't take it away from me. I didn't have keys to the car. I didn't have anything like that. And we lived at the time out by Forest Glen, which is out in the middle of nowhere. No internet, no, you know, cell phone, one bar. The night I called 911, I had one bar. And actually, I no sooner got the quick information out and the address and got disconnected from the police. So they sent three cruisers, I believe, that night, lights and sirens.
In 2004, half of the women who reported experiencing spousal assault by a past partner indicated that the violence occurred after the couple separated. And in one third of post-separation assaults, the violence became more severe or actually began after the separation. In half of all ex-partner homicides against women between 1991 and 1999, the woman was killed within 2 months of leaving the relationship.
There was a couple of years that I was homeless. I was living couch to couch, so to speak. I wasn't homeless as in a tent, but I had not had an address for 2 years, and it was really tough. I did things to survive, such as go on date sites and meet men. I even left the province at one point to have a place to stay for 3 weeks. Sadly, it's like a form of self-harm where you're sleeping with people to survive.
It's important to remember that in this province, fear of extreme violence from perpetrators of intimate partner violence is framed by the worst mass shooting rampage in Canada's history.
At least 16 people, including a policewoman, have been shot dead by a gunman in Canada.
It's being called Canada's deadliest shooting spree ever. At least 16 people are dead after the rampage that started in a small town in Nova Scotia.
The suspect, dressed as a police officer during a 12-hour rampage, is thought to be one of the deadliest mass shootings in the country's history.
Yesterday, we were jolted from that common cause by the senseless violence and tragedy in Nova Scotia.
The profound loss of the lives of 22 people was perpetrated by a man previously reported for violence against women. The calls were reportedly ignored by police.
The gunman's violent past, particularly toward his neighbors, his clients, and his family.
Today, one Mountie offers some explanation for that. They did log it, but found no criminality. So after a few years in the system, the record was wiped.
So yes, safety matters to the women of Nova Scotia. And this is a real crisis. As you can imagine, for an organization like THANS, safety of clients, staff, and volunteers is a priority. But with limitations on funding and resources, the reality can be concerning. Here's Chrysalis House's Brenda Wood.
I have been on occupational health and safety for a long time here. And I remember when we did the first violence in the workplace assessment, we were straight across the top grade, except for the one thing was that we were single staffed. And that has always been a safety issue here. In the old house, I've gone in and worked when we had a threat made against the house. You know, he was going to get a gun and come down. These things happen. The situation with the mass murders really struck home to us that it can happen anywhere, that these men can get extremely violent and extremely lethal.
Jody McDavid has this to say.
And then we also get into the things where, especially around here where everybody knows everybody, that say if you go and stay with like your mother, your mother is really scared that your ex is going to come and burn the house down like he's threatened. You know, you get people who they're able to go to their mothers for a couple of days, but they can't stay there because of the potential danger. Being in a small community, yes, everybody knows everybody. There's a lot of groups on Facebook where people essentially just gossip and like everybody in the town is on them. It's also the type of place, and of course, we caution women when they come in about this, that enough people have been in transition house that they know if they can see a little tiny corner of our building, they know it's our building. They can know our parking lot. You know what I mean? So we had somebody post a selfie before because they were feeling, you know, positive and everything. And somebody posted right on her picture on Facebook, oh, you're in transition house, which she hadn't thought about because she was like, you couldn't really see anything. We had to really caution people like that. And 100% people will say stuff like so-and-so is in transition house and post it all over Facebook and not have any concerns about it.
The community knows where we are now. The decision was that our location would not be secret because the fine line between secret and being shameful is fine. And it's time to stop feeling that this is a shameful thing. This is happening. What we're doing is vital for women. Women need to know where we are. And it's set up so that it's pretty hard to know who's coming into the house. So that's a protection for us and for them.
And a lot of these rural environments, there are guns present because people do hunt and all those sorts of things. So even if that gun has not ever been used to threaten you, it is worrisome. It is there. You know about it. And, you know, and we know from the research that, you know, the presence of a gun creates a situation where it's a much higher risk situation, much more volatile situation.
There are solutions, and the government itself has a plan to make society safer for victims of gender-based violence and women as a whole.
The inquiry into Canada's worst mass shooting continues today in Nova Scotia, the Mass Casualty Commission. For the past 2 days, we have heard the commission focus on the gunman's violent past.
It was important for me to be here today to support the families.
The Mass Casualty Commission was the joint public inquiry created to examine the 2020 mass casualty in Nova Scotia and to provide meaningful recommendations to help make communities safer in the future. Recommendation V16 is titled Putting Women's Safety First and includes many recommendations. In terms of safety, is suggested that all governments and agencies should prioritize women's safety in all strategies and should take steps to ensure women are resourced so they can stay safe and find paths to safety when they are threatened. So, has the government begun to follow its own advice in addressing this lethal crisis?
I think that it's still a work in progress for sure, because the recommendations have not all been put in place. There is a committee that's been formed to ensure that those recommendations get put in place.
Here's Briony House's Lori McGinnis.
They should not be recommendations. They should be requirements. I believe that 100%. A recommendation is something that you can take or not take. You can agree or disagree. You can do it or not. But if it's a requirement of the mass casualty where so many lives were devastated, so many lives were lost, the community was shaken, the province of Nova Scotia, whoever thought that this would happen? Nobody. So they should be requirements. They must be requirements. And I think that these are the things that we need to start working towards with our leaders, our political leaders, the agencies, the powers that be, the funders, that we need to let them know that this is not acceptable. A requirement is something that is acceptable. And then the accountability piece to ensure that it happens. Because otherwise, 10, 5, 15 years, this pack of requirements will be on somebody's desk with dust, and there'll be another situation that we're now going to have an inquiry into, because more loss of life, more devastation.
So at Willow House, we do have a security system. We have cameras and we have panic buttons. And also, if we have a woman who's high risk, chances are good we're going to give her a panic button to wear as well. The panic buttons are typically for staff. So I feel confident in that. The police can get to this location in about 5 minutes. So that's another fail-safe for us. Having the cameras and having them recording is helpful. So I think we've done all that we can do. And, you know, people have to be buzzed to come into the shelter, all those sorts of things, talk through with an intercom, with camera, everything like that. Men aren't allowed on property. So I think that we do have it. We have that stuff pretty figured out.
In this housing landscape, domestic violence is a leading cause of homelessness for women.
Halifax will have a new emergency shelter in late January at the Halifax Forum Multipurpose Building. The 24-hour-a-day men's and women's shelter will have 50 beds to start.
I think we're seeing the tents becoming much more visible and growing in numbers. You know, you'd see a few here and there, and now they're in so many places.
Here's Briony House's Michelle Corbett,
I mean, the hope I have is that these grassroots organizations that have sort of evolved to support people right on site. But there's also risks in shelters. I feel like Briny House offers a vastly different experience than, say, the new shelter that was opened at the Forum. We were actually starting to get some clients that have spent some nights there. And so they're fleeing abuse, and then they're going into an open air sort of shelter, and they're having more negative experiences. It's frightening. Maybe the things are getting stolen. Maybe they're getting threatened. So bringing someone like that in and saying, here's your room. You'll be able to lock your room with the keypad, showing them the different, like the reflection space. Here's a nice living room you can relax in. The meals are provided. We have lots of donations in the basement. It's vastly different than a cot with just a curtain for privacy in a co-ed setting.
Recommendation V14 of the Mass Casualty Commission is titled Mobilizing a Society-Wide Response.
Those who perpetrate mass casualties often have an unaddressed history of gender-based intimate partner or family violence.
The Mass Casualty Commission recommends that a whole-of-society response recognizes the range of actors that have roles and responsibilities to contribute to ending this epidemic, including federal, provincial, territorial, municipal, and Indigenous governments, the health sector and the justice system, the non-governmental and community-based social services sector, businesses and workplaces, media, schools and educational institutions, communities and individuals, including survivors and perpetrators.
Women have been carrying, through community-based organizations, the burden of protecting women almost exclusively for far too long.
We all have work to do. If you've heard some of your own story in this episode and feel a need to reach out for some support, please find your local shelter at thans.ca. Also, if this podcast and its message resonates with you, and you want to help us in our mission, reach out to your local transition house to hear what their needs are. Each shelter has their own website that you can get directed to from thans.ca.